got the password?
Walt sent me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 140 of Walt Sent Me, the podcast where we look at the cinematic legacy of the Walt Disney Company and its various subsidiaries. My name is Todd Liebenow, and with me is Kristen Lopez.
Hello.
And this time we are talking about, well, they can't all be winners, folks. The Hollywood Pictures release, Super Mario Brothers. We've also got a short and just a few pieces of news here. Not a whole lot of news going on, but we do have a few items here. So let's actually start. We got a little bit of a, I don't know whether to call it a trailer or like a sizzle reel or what exactly it was, but we got something from Marvel in the last few weeks here. Basically, that was a thing to kind of say, hey, guys, we got movies that are coming out. You've been waiting a long time, and we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming out for you here. It had like a little voiceover from Stan Lee kind of to get the feels going and all that kind of stuff. And then they basically started kind of showing what's coming up here with a few clips from some things, kind of mainly, I think, to promote Black Widow's release coming up here later in the summer, but also a few other things. Kristen, did you happen to get a look at this? I know you're not big on Marvel, but...
Yeah, this was a big deal when it came out. Mostly the argument I heard was that it was some sort of... Disney likes to make up holidays. so this was like some sort of Marvel celebration thing. So I saw it. It's a sizzle reel, so, you know, it's... interested to get some clips of what Chloe Zhao's Eternals looks like, but
yeah,
nothing really there that I was like, oh, I feel like I know something.
You forgot to say Academy Award winner,
Academy
Chloe
Award
Zhao.
Winner Chloe Zhao.
Yeah,
yes.
Because I mean, you know. I mean, a big deal there. I mean, for Marvel, of course, yeah. That they've got that. And actually, I think, do we technically get to say that Nomadland is a Disney? Because isn't it like Fox Searchlight or something like that?
I believe so. Don't quote me on that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Nomadland is, I think, a Disney film. I can't wait for us to talk about that one.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll get there. But we did get a little bit of news out of this sizzle reel. Like you said, we did get our first look at the Eternals. Really, I mean, only about like 8 seconds worth. I don't know the exact actual time, but it was just fleeting glimpses of things where you really don't have much of an idea about what this is about any more than we did 6 months ago or a year ago, you know, so it's all still kind of a mystery there. But, you know, we got to look at like Angelina Jolie and Salma Hayek and what's his name? The guy from the Big Sick. Oh, I forget his name all the time.
Oh, Camille Nanjiani.
Yeah, looking pretty buff there. Oh, my goodness. But
yeah.
But I think the biggest news to come out of this thing here is we got some official titles on a few of the other films that are coming out. They basically laid out the dates for things. And I mean, when you boil it all down, you've got four films that are going to be coming from Marvel still in 2021. That's including the new Spider-Man one, which is, you know, technically under a different studio. And then four more in 2022. And they kind of laid out a few titles, official titles, on some things that we hadn't been aware of before. Mainly that the Black Panther sequel is going to be called Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Of course, that doesn't clue us into exactly how they're moving things forward there, but I mean, all right, I can get behind that title. And then also the news that Captain Marvel 2 is going to be called The Marvels. And this, I think, from what they're saying here, is also going to tie into some of the Disney Plus stuff, because they're going to have the Miss Marvel series on Disney Plus, and so they're going to be, doing some tie-ins with that in this sequel, I guess.
Yeah, it certainly sounds interesting. They made a big deal about Fantastic Four, I think, too, coming out along the line.
They kind of hinted at it a little bit because they had a big number four at the end there, kind of, you know, because it's phase four, but it was also kind of the logo that we've started to see for the Fantastic Four, whatever that ends up being.
Which, you know, everybody started fan casting, and Emily Blunt does not want to hear about that anymore.
but you know, these people are, it's not uncommon that they lie. You know what I mean? So who knows? She might have been cast already, and she's just being coy about it.
It's also not great for a journalist to go in asking questions about a movie that they know celebrity's not going to talk about, but that's neither here nor there.
That's their job.
trust me, it's my job, and I would never ask that. It's a certain type of writer that would ask that question. I'm excited, but I got some time, so.
And the bottom line on this sizzle reel is that, you know, Marvel's basically saying, don't worry, guys, stuff is coming back. We've got a whole bunch of stuff. I did think it was kind of nice, the little Stan Lee stuff there, which, you know, kind of, I don't know what the exact context of the original quote, you know, the original, you know, interview or whatever it was that came from was, but, you know, it kind of gave, kind of conjured up images of that kind of group experience, you know, being in a theater with people experiencing these things. And, you know, that was kind of neat. It was good to hear that. I got my first trip back to the theater a few weeks ago. I went and saw Godzilla versus Kong. So, you know, I'm like, made that first step. We're getting there, you know?
I'm not there yet. It's probably going to be a while before I am, but, it's interesting to see, you know, that stuff is getting back to normal. I was offered an opportunity to go see Cruella in a theater. I said no. I'd prefer to go see a screener, which I have not watched yet. But you know, I think it's all going to be. I like the option of choice. I think that's what I keep saying. I like the ability to, if I want to go see a movie in a theater, I have that option. If I want to spend $30 to go watch it at home, I have that option. So, mind you, I have not taken Disney up on that opportunity to spend any money on any of their movies, but Jungle Cruise is coming out, and I
get the
suspicion
that
I will probably do that through the premiere access. That will get my money.
I did not have that on my list, but they did announce Jungle Cruise is going to do the premiere access thing. There's also been quite a few stories, you know, running around, not just with Disney films, but for films in general. But Disney specifically, I think, has mentioned that several of the big releases here, looking at like Shang-Chi and things like that, are going to have basically a 45-day theatrical window, and then, you know, the possibilities open up after that. So they're still kind of recognizing that a lot of people are not there yet with getting into the theaters, and probably aren't going to be throughout the rest of this summer season. So they're still trying to get things into theaters, but they are shortening those windows a bit.
I mean, I know we're not a Warner Brothers show, but bless them for day and date, because I've been loving being able to watch the movies. Speaking of Godzilla and Kong, I watched that twice at home and got to make a lot of comments that I probably would not have been able to make in a theater. So it was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, we do have one other bit of news here. This is one that just got me really excited because, I mean, it's no secret on this show that I'm a big fan of the Muppets. And it was announced that there is going to be a Muppet special coming up on Disney Plus here for the Halloween season, Muppet Haunted Mansion. Folks, we've talked a lot about, you know, the Haunted Mansion films and things like that. All right, forget it. This is the Haunted Mansion that we've always wanted, in my opinion, because I love the Muppets. But, you know, when I heard this news, I was like, well, this makes sense. Why haven't they done this before? I mean, the Muppets, to my memory, have not really done any other kind of Halloween thing in the past. I'm like, why not? I mean, they did the Vincent Price episode of The Muppet Show, Alice Cooper. Those were Halloween-ish. But I don't remember them ever doing a Halloween special. And I think that doing it with the Haunted Mansion as the setting, I'm like, fantastic. I'm ready. Give it to me now.
Yeah, this sounds really, really fun. I'm very into this. I hope it's done right. I mean, I've watched the Muppet series that is on the new series they did for Disney Plus, the shorts, and some were far better than others. I wish Disney figured out how to utilize them, and I'm hoping that this is the way that we figure out how to utilize them.
Yeah. I think that's the thing I've been hearing a lot from folks is they keep on saying, well, you know, Disney has really been struggled with how do we use the Muppets? And everyone seems to be in agreement that this sounds like a really good idea. I really hope that they kind of learn from the success that we've seen from, you know, putting the original Muppet shows on Disney Plus. I think a lot of people have really responded very positively to that. And, you know, so I'm saying, all right, well, let's do the Muppet Haunted Mansion, but let's put in there some of those elements that we love from those original shows. You know, give me some guest stars, give me some musical numbers, things like that, and kind of bring those two things together. I think, at least in my book, that's kind of the recipe for success here with this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all the news that we have this time. So let's talk about a short.
Episode is from 1936. It is called Donald and Pluto. This is a Walt Disney short that was distributed through their partnership with United Artists. It's directed by Ben Sharpstein. Ben Sharpstein was a regular director. He was predominantly a sequence supervising production director on pretty much all of the big Disney shorts. He did do a documentary short for Disney called Waterbirds, as well as a couple other documentary shorts, as well as the DTV music videos, if you remember. Not a huge director in the grand scheme of things for the company, but well remembered for the stuff that he did.
They got to get those DTV things on Disney Plus. Those were so much fun.
I remember, I want to say I have a disc somewhere that I bought along with the Halloween special that they used to show. But the story for Donald and Pluto is that Donald is a plumber fixing pipes in a basement, and he's trying to pull his hammer off of a magnet, and when he unscrews the lid that covers the pipe, water spurts out and hits him in the face, and to stop the flow, he uses the magnet to pull a larger hammer toward him, which he uses to put on another lid, but he accidentally wakes up Pluto and takes his bone away from him, and Pluto is wrestling with the magnet to get his bone back, only he swallows the magnet and gets his bone stuck to his bottom, and he ends up getting a lot of things attracted to his backside as the magnet wreaks havoc. Very simple premise to this one. I don't know why it necessarily deserves to be 8 full minutes, but this one's a fun one. I don't know why it's called Donald and Pluto per se, because it's really Pluto's short.
Mostly Pluto, yeah.
And I think Pluto shorts are always hard because he's a dog. It's not really easy to, you know what, I'm going to ask you, Todd, why are the Pluto shorts kind of the weakest shorts in the grand scheme of things, even compared to like other animal characters like Chip and Dale?
Yeah, I agree. I think the Pluto shorts are a challenge. And I think part of it is because you kind of go back and forth between, you know, sympathizing with Pluto and going, well, he's got what's coming to him here, because Pluto at times can come across as a kind of pathetic character, and he can come off sometimes as being a lovable character, and he can come off sometimes as being kind of a mean character. And I think that's where I've always struggled with those shorts, is that I don't have a clear hole that I can put that Pluto peg into. You know, I can go, Donald has a temper, Mickey is lovable, Goofy is, you know, not so smart, but Pluto seems to kind of waffle between these different things. And I don't know, when I watch a lot of Pluto shorts, I do struggle, like in those moments where, you know, like he wails in pain over something, you know, that howl that Pluto does just always kind of grates on me. And you know, I don't know whether to, you know, feel sorry for him or what. And so I agree. I think Pluto shorts can really be a struggle sometimes.
It's true. And I think a lot of that is the fact that Pluto doesn't necessarily have the same level of personality as Chip and Dale does. You know, if you had to sum up Mickey Mouse, you could do that in 3 words. Same with any of the Fab Five. Even Daisy, I think, to an extent, you could say what her character traits are. what are Pluto's character traits? He's a dog.
He's a dog. She gets into trouble sometimes. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's really what the short is. He's a dog who gets into trouble. He's swallowed a magnet. Things get stuck to his butt. It's not the most complex short, but I think it does lead to a lot of fun. But I would have maybe preferred some more of Donald's patented brand of anger management.
I agree. I think one of the things where I thought this short was a little bit misguided, and I'm with you. I think that there's a lot of fun things in this short, but I did think it was weird how this is a short that begins feeling like it's going to be about one thing and then changes. You know, it starts out with Donald as a plumber, and he's banging away on these things, and he's got this magnet, which first I'm like, well, why has he got a magnet? That's not your typical plumbing tool that I'm aware of. I mean, not that I'm an expert. The last type of handyman job I want to do around the house ever is plumbing stuff. You know, water sprays everywhere. It's no good. But, you know, he's using this magnet to, like, pick up stuff, I guess, because he's too lazy to reach down and pick things up. And I'm thinking, all right, you know, we're going to have Donald Duck doing plumbing here. And that's, you know, a comedic formula that's been used in lots of cartoons. It's used in lots of, you know, live action comedy shorts. I mean, I think the Three Stooges did, you know, at least two, maybe three short subjects where they're plumbers, you know. So it's something that's got a lot of comedic potential. But then it very quickly changes from being about Donald doing plumbing to Pluto has swallowed a magnet. Which, again, is a really common premise. You often see cartoons where a character has swallowed a magnet. And I was like, okay, I mean, that's been used hundreds of times. And, yeah, I mean, some of the payoff is good here, but I really wanted more of Donald messing with the pipes and getting sprayed with water and letting his temper run wild.
Exactly. There could have been something with the home renovation, although you're right, we have seen a lot of Disney home renovation type of shorts in terms of whether that's ghosts or whether that's chipmunks or something like that. So this is, I think, lower tier on pretty much all of the plots that this movie, that this short is cribbing from. And mostly I think Donald and Pluto are a bad match.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd agree with that because I think, again, if we look at those top tier characters, yeah, they don't go together well because, like I say, Pluto can come across as kind of pathetic. He often has those moments where he howls in pain and you feel sorry for the poor guy. But then Donald is this guy that gets angry all the time. So you don't want your most angry character and your most pathetic character together, you know?
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, I feel this is just bottom tier Disney shorts. But even then, it's still entertaining.
Yeah, yeah. I did kind of some of the gags, I think, especially towards the end, I enjoyed. I mean, the bit with where, you know, Pluto is up one floor and his backside, because he swallowed the magnet, is stuck to the floor. And then Donald's got the hammer, which is stuck to the ceiling on the bottom. And the two are moving around and causing trouble for each other. I thought that was a pretty clever sequence. I kept kind of wanting to say, Donald, you know, you can just let go of the hammer. You don't have to be hanging there from the ceiling. But, you know, it's a cartoon. It doesn't work if they do things like that, you know. And I think on a whole, I mean, there's good stuff going on here from an animation standpoint. I mean, this is still relatively early. I mean, this is 1936. We're not in the sweet spot quite yet that we've talked about with kind of those mid to late 40s, 50s cartoons where there's just that crispness, you know, that really clean animation and colors that just pop. You don't quite have that here, but still, I mean, the Disney artists were the best there were out there, and they, you know, they do a fine job with this, but it's not the height of what we've seen from some of the other shorts that we've talked about.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just basic. It's basic, Disney.
It's basic, but it's still entertaining. Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our look at Super Mario Brothers.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm John.
And we are the hosts of the Popcorn Auteur, a movies podcast where each episode we immerse ourselves in and critique the works of a famous filmmaker.
The concept is pretty straightforward. Chris and I pick a famous filmmaker, watch their films over a short time frame, then we talk about the films, mispronounce French words, and answer definitively, is this filmmaker an auteur and do we like them?
Subscribe and download episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
Okay, I got it. Let's go. Come on.
Just let me do the talking.
Shut up.
Keep it down.
Boys, boys. Sit down.
How's prison?
You look like hell. I'm Larry Lazard of Lazard Lazard, Conda, Dactyl, and Cohen.
Who sent you? Are you from the city?
No, I'm from that little part of all of us that can't stand to see someone else in need or in pain.
Yeah, I bet. Who's this Cooper clown? We gotta talk to that goofball now.
I don't think you want to do that.
Why?
Why not? That Koopa clown?
Yeah.
Is one evil, egg-sucking son of a snake. Now, where is that meteorite piece?
The what?
You know what I'm talking about!
No one touches President Koopa.
No Koopa? Well, you just said you were wrong.
An evil, egg-sucking son of a snake.
Did I lie?
Take these two plumbers to the Devo chamber.
Come on.
Come on.
Okay, so our feature film this time comes to us from 1993. It is, believe it or not, the very first film based on a video game. And we all know where things have gone from there, folks. So, not a genre that is very well respected, and this film is probably part of the reason why. This is Super Mario Brothers. This is, of course, based on the uber-popular video game of the same name. Video game franchise, I should say. I mean, the original video game came out, I think, in the mid to late 80s and was kind of the anchor game of the Nintendo Entertainment System, which was a cultural phenomenon at that time. Here we are in the early 90s trying to make it into a movie. It's directed by the husband and wife team of Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jenkel. Big name directors there. I'm sure you've heard of all their films. Yeah. The only other thing really I could find that I recognized they'd done was the movie DOA, starring Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan, which came out in 1988. That was also a Disney release that came out through Touchstone. But yeah, this is a movie that it is not highly regarded.
Keep in mind, too, they were also the creators of Max Headroom.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yes. So that, I mean, Max Headroom, I mean, there was a series that had a bit of a cult following. It didn't last very long, but I always remember more Max Headroom because he did, like, Coke or Pepsi commercials. I don't remember which. The other thing I remember about Max Headroom, oh, this is going to show, all right, this is creepy. I grew up in the Chicago area, and those who grew up in the Chicago area in the 80s, you'll remember where on a Sunday night, suddenly the local PBS station was interrupted during its broadcast of Doctor Who by a pirate broadcast of some guy in a Max Headroom costume, and he, like, dropped his trousers and got spanked, and it was all fuzzy and warbly, and it was just the creepiest thing. I mean, it gave us nightmares, you know. If you've never seen that before, go on YouTube, look up Chicago Doctor Who Max Headroom. You'll see what I mean. It's disturbing. Anyway, we got way off subject there. Kristen, what is your background, not with Max Headroom, but with Super Mario Brothers? First of all, I mean, are you a video game fan? Are you a fan of the game? Anything like that?
I've played Super Mario Brothers. I grew up, my brother and I grew up with Sega. All of the video game systems that you had, you know, had up until, I think, like, a PlayStation 2 is when I stopped following what was going on. But no, we played a lot of Super Mario. I played it on my Game Boy that I had at the time. So I was aware of the games. It wasn't Sonic the Hedgehog, which was, like, my go-to game. But it was something that I was well aware of. And I know this movie very well. My little brother was a huge fan of this. We watched this a lot, to the point where I vowed that I would never, ever watch this again, because we watched it regularly. I would say maybe every other week at some point. It was chronic in our house, along with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies. So I despised this movie before we watched talked about it, and I have not seen this probably in a good 20 years. Probably, let's be kinder, 25. And I watched it again for this podcast, and all of those feelings of like, yep, nope. If anything, time has not given me like nostalgia lenses for this movie. I still think this is garbage.
I agree, it's garbage. I'm looking forward to digging into the garbage in this particular case. I will tell you that, you know, I have a unique history with this in that I, of course, was a fan of the game. I mean, you know, you were the coolest kid on the block if you had an NES, you know, and Super Mario Brothers was the game everybody had. And, you know, I enjoy that game. I enjoy kind of the world building and the mythology of that series of games, you know, the different characters and all that. I think it's a lot of fun. And I was really looking forward to this movie back in 1993. I was in college. I was getting ready to head out. I was going to be spending the summer across the country in Colorado, where I now live. You know, it kind of was that first step on that journey there. But I remember it was a summer where I was going to miss seeing a lot of movies because I was going to be busy with this opportunity in Colorado. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to get to see Super Mario Brothers. I didn't miss much in the theater, I'll tell you that. But yeah, this is a movie that I struggle with a lot, because I think that I can see that they were being ambitious about a few things, but I'm going, were there any fans of the game involved in this at all? Because it doesn't feel at all like Super Mario Brothers.
No, exactly. And, you know, we can talk a lot about where exactly this movie went off the rails. I mean, it's an insane kind of series of events of how this movie was put together and produced by Roland Joffe, who did The Mission, which just makes me wonder, like, all the things about why a director of serious films like this would really want to produce a Super Mario Brothers movie. But we can get into the how did it get made in a second.
Get into what it's about. Kristen's going to do that as she usually does, but good luck.
Okay.
This one's a challenge.
So, I don't know if you know this, but dinosaurs once ruled the Earth. And somehow...
No, dinosaurs once ruled Brooklyn. That's what the movie tells us, yes.
Okay. So dinosaurs, when the meteorite crashed into Earth, it actually didn't kill the dinosaurs per se. It split the universe into two parallel dimensions, where the surviving dinosaurs were in one dimension and evolved into essentially humans with dinosaur-esque cosplay, you know, hairstyles. 20 years later... At some point, a woman leaves an egg along with a rock at an orphanage and is killed, kind of like the beginning of Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But then the present day, okay, so stay with me. We went 65 million years ago, then 20 some odd years from 1993, and then the present day, which is 1983. So in the present day, you have Italian-American plumbers Mario and Luigi Mario. Their last name is Mario, which means Mario's first Mario, and last Mario. Name is Mario.
Yeah.
Played by Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo, respectively. They live in Brooklyn. They are going to be driven out of business by the mafia. And one day they meet a young woman named Daisy, played by Samantha Mathis, who Luigi falls for. She's digging under the Brooklyn Bridge for dinosaur bones. And after a date, she is kidnapped and taken through an interdimensional portal to the city of Dino-Hatton. And Luigi and Mario go in there and realize that it is a whole alternate universe that is inconsistently utilizing dinosaur stuff to create this world where everybody's under the thumb of President Koopa, played by Dennis Hopper. Legendary performer Dennis Hopper. Mm-hmm. we can talk about Dennis Hopper's career at a different point in time. And he, of course, wants Daisy and the meteorite that she wears around her neck because it can blend the two universes together. Of course, that can't happen. Hijinks ensue. There's a dance associated with this movie. I think that's the plot. That's the whole plot, right? Yeah. I hit everything.
That's kind of the plot. Yeah, exactly. Which I'm going, is there any Super Mario Brothers game before 1993 or after that has anything to do with anything like this? That's the thing. I'm like, I'm totally down for a movie based on Super Mario Brothers.
I will ask you one question that I had. Well, there are many questions that I had, but I will ask you the biggest question. Who's narrating this movie?
Who is narrating the movie?
Who is the narrator?
At the beginning, there's a bit of narration. I don't know.
Exactly. Why is Homer Simpson from The Simpsons, it's Dan Castellaneta, who is the narrator, but he's not in the movie. So, like, what character is narrating this movie? This is the only movie that I can think of that has a narrator, outside of the 1940s, that has a narrator that has absolutely nothing to do with the plot of this film or any of the characters. You wanted to hear how this movie got made. I went down a rabbit hole and did some research. Probably helped that I had watched Dungeons & Dragons for another podcast, and I was really into researching how bad video games or game movies were being made in the 90s.
I sympathize with you more now, Kristen. I mean, it was bad enough that I subjected you to this film, but then you watched Dungeons & Dragons.
Dungeons & Dragons, but sadly, it was not the first time I'd watched Dungeons & Dragons. So I was, that's really just myself. That's my sadomasochistic me, apparently.
Hey, at least Ben Kingsley isn't in this one. So
Ben Kingsley isn't in Dungeons & Dragons.
I thought he was.
Jeremy Irons is in Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, that's all right. I knew someone big was in there.
Yeah, Ben Kingsley dodged that bullet. So they wanted to make Roland Joffe, who directed The Mission, wanted to make a Super Mario Brothers movie. He had a studio. He wanted to make it. He met the president of Nintendo and presented them with the script and pitched to them the storyline, which made them really interested. He left with a $2 million contract that gave him actual temporary control over the Mario character. But Nintendo retained the merchandising through this creative partnership. And when Joffe was asked why Nintendo should sell the rights to them over, you know, like a big company with money, he assured them that Nintendo would have control over the film. But really, Nintendo didn't care. They didn't want to make a movie per se. They thought that the brand was strong enough that they could just kind of mess around with it and see what stuck. But Joffe said they weren't really interested in how it got made or what was going on with it. The first script they had was written by Barry Morrow, who you might know is the screenwriter of Rain Man. And they said that his story was an existential road trip with Mario and Luigi that was supposed so similar to Rain Man that production called it Drain Man. And yes. And they said that it was really more of a drama as opposed to this comedy. So they got screenwriters Jim Genwine and Tom Parker to write a more traditional adaptation, something that they compared to like The Wizard of Oz. It was to subvert fairy tale cliches and satirize them, as well as focus on the relationship between Mario and Luigi, which they said was essentially what Shrek did. But they did it earlier, so it didn't really work. They were going to get Greg Beeman, who had directed License to Drive, to direct this. They had pre-production, but because Greg Beeman had made Mom and Dad Save the World, which had bombed disastrously, he got fired. They then offered the director position to Harold Ramis. But even though he really enjoyed the video game, he said no, which he said was actually a good decision because it was a bad disaster of a film. So they tried a bunch of different things. They could not get the tone right. And that's when Roland Joffe started thinking of Max Headroom. He traveled to Rome to meet with the Max Headroom creators of Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jankel. And Morton said that they were really more of the Tim Burton school of filmmaking. They had a background that was more in animation and comic books, and so they really wanted to make this big, exaggerated film, which Joffe really liked, that they were going to make this dark tone, very similar to 1989's Batman, as well as the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie. Supposedly it was going to be this very dark, provocative film that would have been a prequel to the games that tells the, quote, true story behind Nintendo's inspiration. So it's essentially about the character of Buzz Lightyear, like the real Buzz Lightyear Buzz Lightyear.
Oh no.
So they were going to make this mythic vision of New York that was going to essentially say, the interpretation was that Nintendo interpreted the events from the movie and came up with the video game. That was the concept. And so if you're talking, Todd, about things that they borrowed from the video game, the dinosaurs were inspired by Dinosaur Land, which had recently been released in Super Mario World. The fungus was also the concept of the mushrooms from the games. Jankel envisioned the parallel dimension as, quote, a whole world with a reptile point of view dominated by aggressive primordial behavior and basic instincts that holds fossil fuels sacred. It was essentially a parody of New York and heavy industry. They were going to hopefully base it off of Ghostbusters, which was like dark, but also funny. And at the same time, they also had screenwriters Parker Bennett and Terry Wunte to write this script and bring it all together. Well, even though they were working with the directors, Bennett and Wunte were fired by the producers for being too comedic. So they got the British writing team of Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenaise to deliver a more adult and feminist film. So Princess Daisy, the Samantha Mathis character, and Lena, played by Fiona Shaw, of all people, their roles were expanded while they introduced the character of Bertha, the film's lone woman of color, to gussy it up. The script was approved by the main cast. They got Bob Hoskins to play the role along the way. The film moved into pre-production. But by this point, Joffe thought the project had skewed too far from the young adult and family audiences and was also too effects heavy, which meant more expensive to film within their budget. So without informing Morton and Jankel or the cast, they hired screenwriters Ed Solomon and Ryan Rowe to essentially write a new script while they were in pre-production, which was more family-friendly with a more restrained effects requirement. It was also partially motivated by the fact that Disney during this time was distributing the film. And it was only once the cast arrived on set that they realized that the script had been changed. Morton and Jankel thought about leaving the project, but they decided to stay and realized that no other directors at that point could come on and understand the material enough to work with it the way that they could. And they also felt that they owed it to the cast and crew and felt that maybe they could find their vision within the new production. But yeah, you know, we all know how that went. But supposedly the original script, which Leguizamo and Hoskins will tell you, you know, had far more provocative adult elements, which you can kind of see in the nightclub sequence. They said that there were, you know, like strippers and prostitutes in some sequences, but that's how we got the movie that we got.
Well, and, you know, some of the things you're saying there really, I mean, makes sense when you view the finished product. And as I watch it, I go, yeah, it really looks like they are trying to do something that they think is going to give this kids property some legitimacy, that, you know, we're going to make it serious, we're going to, you know, we're going to make this dark. And that, when you mentioned the Batman influence, I mean, that's definitely something that I think just screams out as you watch this movie, that this is the feel they're going for here is much like Batman. I think the other film that really jumps out at me that I go, oh, they watched Total Recall a few too many times, because just kind of the grimy feel of this dinosaur city or whatever, just it feels a lot like Mars in Total Recall to me.
Oh, I can definitely see the Total Recall influences. I see the Ninja Turtles references. I see a lot of other, and that tends to be the problem, right? When we talk about these big failed projects, it seems like they're so desperate to emulate other films that had come out. And yeah, this is just a weird one, because for all of its attempts to copy a million other movies, it ultimately doesn't feel at all like the source material that it's trying to adapt.
Have the name, and then they just did something completely different. I mean, there are seriously, you know, cases in this movie where you've got, like, these random characters that just have absolutely nothing to do with anything out of the video game world, but they've slapped a couple of names from the video game characters onto them, so it's supposed to have some connection. I'm thinking primarily of, like, Fisher Stevens and Richard, what's his name? Richard Edson's characters. They're just these random henchmen type of guys, but they slapped the names Spike and Iggy on them, which are names out of the video game. So I was like, oh, okay, we're supposed to think they're these guys from the video game who actually aren't a pair in the video games. They don't really have anything to do with each other other than they're both bad guys. And so, yeah, I mean, all these things that people really wanted to see that were fans of the game, they're not there.
Exactly. And, you know, the things that we would recognize, you know, I will never not understand why she's Princess Daisy and not Princess Peach.
Well, I asked my son the other day, I'm like, because he's a big, big gamer, okay? He could tell me every single character from every Mario game, every Sonic game, every whatever, okay? I said, what's the difference between Daisy and Peach? He's like, Daisy's got brown hair.
That also shows the inherent misogyny in the video game landscape. But I mean, those are the things, like the things you don't really know. You know, the point of a video game movie is to induct new fans into the series, you know, so you want those commonly identifiable things, but then you also want to appease fans of the games. And like, there's nothing really that is identifiable for the people that play the games, nor for the people that don't know the games. I mean, the Yoshi element, you know, when they introduce Yoshi, it's this weird kind of Jurassic Park ripoff type of thing, you know, before Jurassic Park even came out.
Yeah, this is the same summer as Jurassic Park.
So. Yeah, and it like looks cheaper, you know, it's like knockoff and you know, if you hadn't told me that was Yoshi, I would have never known.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. I remember when they first started to release photos from this and seeing in a magazine this picture of Yoshi, I'm going, why does he look like a dinosaur? And I'm like, I never thought of Yoshi as being a dinosaur from the games. I always just thought he was just kind of this cute little green guy, you know, dragon type of thing. I never thought of him as being a baby T-Rex. So, you know, seeing him in the movie looking like that, I was like, that's kind of disturbing. I'm not down for that.
Well, the use of the dinosaur stuff is just so inconsistent and haphazard. You know, I've talked about this with world building before. You know, if you're going to commit to something otherworldly, you really have to commit. And the concept of a dinosaur universe that really does just look like New York. I mean, it just looks like New York in the 80s. You know, it's not really, you know, primordial or weird in any way. It's just, you know, Dennis Hopper has, you know, weird hair or something, you know, or characters have spikes on their clothes. Like, none of that's really dinosaur to me,
right?
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and even, like you say, it's not consistent. I mean, these big henchmen-type guys that are, you know, 7 feet tall and have little dinosaur heads. You know, then you have the ones that have the little mushroom heads, and I'm like, well, okay, who's a dinosaur and who's a mushroom, and this all looks weird, and why are their heads so darn small anyway? You know, it just looks weird. It actually just looks like a costume that's, you know, meant to hide that they've got, you know, kind of, you know, bad animatronics and puppetry going on there, you know?
Exactly. And I don't really understand the concept of the devolution thing that they're doing, you know, with the Goombas, which is like their dinosaurian mafia, which I don't know if that's kind of like an inside joke at like the mob or something. I don't know.
Well, Goombas is a name that comes from the game. I know that. There's like little evil mushrooms that are called Goombas.
But I wouldn't have known that if you hadn't told me. And that's the thing. It's such an inconsistent concept, you know, that it's almost like the dinosaur thing just becomes set dressing that you don't really need. I don't know how I could have told the story better, you know, but the use of Dinosaur City just looks like it comes from a crappy video game that I would never play.
Well, and you gave all that backstory, and I'm a little surprised, and you know, maybe this actually happened and it's just not documented anywhere. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if they really laid into the dinosaur stuff because they knew Jurassic Park was coming out. I mean, that was, you know, the big movie for that year. And you know, we knew that was going to be coming for years in advance. So it wouldn't surprise me if in the course of production of this, they go, hey, we're going to be coming out around the same time as Steven Spielberg doing dinosaurs. Let's do some dinosaurs too.
Well, you bring up a good point. So the creature designer and supervisor for this film was Patrick Tatopoulos, who most people know as the designer of the 1997 Godzilla. Nelson on movie one wants to be associated with, but he was aware that, that Jurassic Park was filming and consciously designed the dinosaurs here to be cute and cartoon-like. He took a lot of his inspiration, oddly enough, from Beetlejuice. Don't really know where he got that, but
yeah, it doesn't really look, you know, like Beetlejuice, but
exactly. So he wanted Yoshi to be, quote, an abstract fantasy T-Rex that had large eyes to be softer and less menacing. So they actually tried to make Yoshi a cross between a T-Rex and an iguana. And supposedly producers from Jurassic Park visited the set and were so impressed with the Yoshi puppet that they kind of can almost consider for a minute hiring his engineers for a second Jurassic Park creature shop.
I don't know. I'm not seeing it. I think these, I think Yoshi looks pretty, I don't know. That what I compare it to is like, you know, in the wake of Jurassic Park came, you know, a string of other dinosaur films, some of them made by the likes of Roger Corman. The Yoshi dinosaur looks like a Roger Corman dinosaur to me. But
well, let's talk about the story, because I mean, I feel like the story doesn't help either. The narrative of A to B that is this movie.
Well, it's one of those stories that we see a lot. You know, it's kind of one of those kind of lazy type of stories where it's okay, there's this thing that we've got to get back that's so important to the fate of the universe and things like that, you know. And I mean, it's like just like out of like a Transformers movie where it's like, hey, we must get that thing that spins and glows, whatever that is, you know. I mean, we must get it because the fate of the universe depends on it. It's kind of like that type of thing. It's actually, it's almost like the same storyline, and I'm not saying this is bad because I love the Dark Crystal, but it's almost the same device as the Dark Crystal. We've got the shard and we must get it back into the meteor. We've got the shard and we must get it back to the Dark Crystal. You know, it's the same thing.
Well, and there's just so much backstory in order to make any of the dinosaur stuff. I mean, all of this is in service to the dinosaur land, all of the narrative. So, you know, the opening narration, the 20 years earlier scene with Samantha Mathis playing her own mother, and all of that is in service of creating this plot wherein the MacGuffin, which is the meteorite piece that Daisy wears, that bridges the land, the two universes together. Now, what that's supposed to mean per se, we don't really know, other than the dinosaur people will be in regular Earth.
Mm-hmm. And see, you know, when we get to that point in the movie and we actually have a brief moment where Dennis Hopper and his goons show up in, you know, Manhattan or Brooklyn,
it's not
I should
that
say.
Bad.
It's kind of like we spend about 30 seconds there with that. And then we go back. It's kind of going, well, come on, man, let's have a dinosaur going down Times Square and things like that. You know, you missed an opportunity. But again, maybe that's, you know, they pulled back. They didn't want so many effects, et cetera, you know?
Well, I mean, so much, at least the first like 20, 25 minutes of this movie is Mario and Luigi kind of setting them up, setting up the Scapelli brothers, who are the mob company that is trying to put Luigi and Mario out of business, but is also trying to get rid of Daisy's expedition. And, or, okay, I mean, they have really no bearing on things. And once they get to platform 9 3/4, or whatever the little area is that they can cross over, I mean, it takes a while to get the narrative set up. And then once it happens, it's just a series of Mario and Luigi being caught,
yeah,
and then being held in different locations and having to escape. I mean, you can almost see the very blocky outline of the script, you know, which is just like Mario and Luigi captured in this detaining facility. Mario and Luigi have to escape nightclub. Mario and Luigi in this crowd. I mean, it's just very blocky scenes that begin and end and do very little but to move the characters like game pieces almost. That's the most game-like element of this movie, which is how the movie itself plays out.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no real sense of relationship between any of these characters, whether that's Mario and Luigi, whether that's Luigi and Daisy, whether that's Daisy and her, you know, connection to Dino Hatton. And for a movie called Super Mario Brothers, the emphasis of them being brothers, I mean, there are a few moments where John Leguizamo and Bob Hoskins try very hard to sell some of the dialogue that is meant to connect them. You know, like Luigi talking about how he was an orphan and Mario raised him his entire life. I mean, those scenes are well acted in the hopes of making you care about their relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I feel like things like that are just there to kind of, you know, explain what, why is, you know, Mario seems so much older than Luigi does. You know, and why is this not the Luigi that we're used to from the games? I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is strange with this movie is the casting, to be honest with you. I mean, when they announced Bob Hoskins was going to be playing Mario, I was like, all right, that makes sense. He looks like Mario. He's a good actor. He's in Roger Rabbit and stuff like that. I like Bob Hoskins. I was down for it. I admit, at the time this came out, I probably, like a lot of people, didn't know who John Leguizamo was. He wasn't the name that he is now when this movie came out. But the idea of making Luigi a love interest, to make it where it's like, you know, Mario looks like, you know, Mario from the game, and then we're trying to maybe make Luigi like a bit of a heartthrob here, that just didn't jive with me.
Well, the casting was also difficult. Dustin Hoffman briefly expressed interest in portraying Mario, but Nintendo didn't think that he was the right man for the role. Danny DeVito was offered both the role of Mario and the chance to direct. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Michael Keaton were both approached to play Koopa, and they turned it down. And Tom Hanks was considered for the role of Luigi, but because he had had a string of box office failures, the studio decided he wasn't worth casting.
Wow, imagine that, a time when Tom Hanks was not a bankable star.
Yes, and Bob Hoskins disliked the script at the beginning and did not want to do another children's film, especially because he had done Roger Rabbit and he'd done Hook. He said, quote, "I didn't want to become like Dick Van Dyke." But he did take it after Joffe just kept pushing him. And John Leguizamo at the time was a up-and-coming stand-up comedian. He had done a lot of really interesting work, I think, for Second City and some of the comedy clubs in the country. And so he was this young, you know, new face. And I have to agree with him. The one thing I love about this movie is the fact that often Italians historically played Latinos in film, you know, like Al Pacino in Scarface. Mm-hmm. And this movie flips that because John Leguizamo is Latino and he's playing Italian. And I do love that that is how it plays out. Really, though, I was surprised this movie doesn't play on, as much as all the other characters are Italian stereotypes, again, like the Goombas and the Scapelli brothers, this movie doesn't really have a lot of Mario and Luigi playing Italian stereotypes,
yeah.
which is fascinating. I mean, I like both of them. I think they try very hard to do what they can with this material. You know, Bob Hoskins is playing the crotchety, you know, kind of grumpy dad who doesn't really know what's going on. John Leguizamo is, yeah, the scrappy romantic, you know, which I don't really get. And even if you listen to some of his comedy specials from the early 90s, he would tell you he was not like a Lothario at all. But they try. They try very hard. And I don't blame this movie's failures on them at all.
No, I think that they did about as well as they could with what was given to them. I do think there's times where I think with just about every character in this. I feel like each one is kind of in their own space, in their own movie that, you know, like you say, they're not really jiving together. I actually think the most appealing out of the leads in the cast is Daisy, is Samantha Mathis, which I know she was kind of up and coming at the time as well. She was coming right off of Pump Up the Volume, which was kind of an unexpected hit.
She had Little Women, I think, the year after this.
Yeah, I think that came after.
Yeah, 94.
So, you know, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, you have these two iconic video game characters of Mario and Luigi, and I find myself, appreciating much more their leading lady in this film.
Oh, I would maintain as I was watching this that if this movie was just Samantha Mathis and Fiona Shaw, it would have been great. Because, I mean, Samantha Mathis is playing the babe in the woods. I think that she is the 90s definition of girl power, in that you had a bunch of dudes writing what they thought a strong woman of the 90s is. Like, oh, she takes up dinosaur bones and wears cargo pants. You know, there's really no agency to her beforehand. And she's just kind of a damsel until she gets to Dino Hatton and she is playing off of Fiona Shaw's Lena, that she actually has. There's some stakes there. And then they have some dumb stuff about her dad being a fungus bubble or something. It gets so dumb. But I will say, I think the MVP of this film is Fiona Shaw. I was actually shocked to see her name in these credits. I would not have remembered her being in this movie. And the fact that she is now, you know, I mean, she was always a great actor, but I mean, she's a 3-time Emmy nominee. Okay. And she's in this movie, like one of the star, you know, one of the performers in the Harry Potter franchise. Yeah. And she is the only character, I think, that knows exactly what type of movie she is making. Because Lena is Koopa's, like, Girl Friday. She's the Halle Berry of the Flintstones, you know, where it's just, like, she's the bad girl. Yeah. But at the same time, like, she also wants some power, and that's really cool. And she wears the clothes, like, they're made for her, you know. She's got such regal presence in this movie, and she's the only performer that, like, can say the lines with seriousness and fear. Like, the sequence that she has with Daisy where they're, like, kind of going back and forth, it's intense. It's great. Where is this movie? Like, I would support both of these two making a movie together. So, congratulations, Fiona Shaw, for making this movie tolerable for the few minutes that you were on screen.
All right. Well, we've talked about certain members of the cast, but we have jumped over what I think is the most bizarre that we need to talk about here, and that is Mr. Dennis Hopper.
Oh, God.
I don't even know how to categorize this performance. And I mean, and you know, granted, we're talking about Dennis Hopper. This is someone that has done so many different, unique, diverse, bizarre things on screen. And yet I just cannot quite put my finger on what he's doing here in this movie.
So Dennis Hopper explained why he did the film. He said that he had a 6-year-old son at the time who said to him, quote, "Dad, I think you're probably a pretty good actor, but why did you play that terrible guy King Koopa in Super Mario Brothers?" And Dennis Hopper said, quote, "Well, Henry, I did that so you could have shoes." And he said, "Dad, I don't need shoes that badly." I mean, this was before Dennis Hopper did Speed. This was the year before. And Dennis Hopper's made his fair share of garbage. He is just so over the top. This is like if you took the character from Speed and then put him in some dinosaur movie. I mean, he's doing what Jeremy Irons is doing in Dungeons & Dragons, which is like, just go over the top and collect that sweet payday. Like, it doesn't matter what you're saying. Yeah. Just say the lines. And the biggest problem is Koopa's not really a big bad. Like, his plan's kind of dumb. He's not really a presence, despite it being Dennis Hopper. If anything, he's more like a pervert, because we have that one really weird scene with him and Samantha Mathis where it gets a little assaulty, like a little, like, maybe you should take, like, 8 steps back, sir.
Yeah, that's another one of those moments where you go, yeah, they were, kind of saying, forget the kiddies, let's do something dark here.
The problem that I have, and I think that scene just makes me mad, because it's that's it. That's the only scene in the movie that is like that, and there's nothing leading up to it. Like, this isn't one of those movies where, the character of the villain, has a plan to, marry the young girl because she is the keys to the kingdom or something, the princess. Mm-hmm. We've seen movies like that, right? Where the old guy's like, well, it's Aladdin all over again. We've seen that. This isn't like that. It's just, one scene where he's like, it's like if Captain Barbossa during that dinner scene in Pirates of the Caribbean was gonna actually try to physically assault Elizabeth. It's just weird. Yeah. It makes no sense. And it doesn't, nothing else in the movie after that touches that. And I just don't understand why it exists here.
Well, there's a lot of things in this movie that I don't understand why they exist.
I mean, kudos to whoever designed Dennis Hopper's hairstyle. That's it.
That's the most memorable thing about the movie, and it's crazy.
Exactly. There are so many questions that I have with this movie.
Well, we should probably get into box office, things like that. I mean, I know it was not a hit, and I think it was, I want to say this was even one of the kickoff movies of that summer. I think it even opened Memorial Day weekend, which, is typically a time for big, big movie release.
Yeah, this movie had a budget of 42 to 48 million, depending on who you ask. And it grossed a little over 20 million in the U.S. and Canada, selling approximately 5 million tickets in the U.S. In Asia, the film grossed about 2.7 million in Japan, and it made about 4 million in the U.K. The critical response was negative. People thought it was too light on story, and most people just didn't like it. I'm trying to see if Roger Ebert wrote, of course he did. So Siskel and Ebert gave the film two thumbs down, citing tonal inconsistency and lack of narrative. It was on their list for one of the worst films of 1993. My favorite review is Stephen Hunter of the Baltimore Sun, who thought Yoshi had, quote, more personality than all the human actors put together. it was one of four Disney-related films under consideration for the Best Visual Effects Award at the 66th Annual Academy Awards, but the Academy ultimately nominated The Nightmare Before Christmas. So the movie total grossed about $20 million. Not a big thing. Bob Hoskins would go on to say that this was the worst film that he ever made. Supposedly, he and John Leguizamo got super drunk each day before they would film and would drink in between takes, which I could see, but Bob Hoskins' son did love the movie and said that his, dad was really good. All of the actors and directors have gone on to do fan conventions, and when this movie has an anniversary, they're usually there in support of it. So, I do think that they've come around to it as the fans have, and this is one of the first video game movies to actually be directed by a woman. So that's a big deal as well.
It does have its fans. I know that. I mean, pretty much any bad movie, there are folks out there that just adore it and it's their favorite thing. I could appreciate it on a certain level. I mean, I love sitting down for a bad movie every now and then. And I can take Super Mario Brothers every few years or so, but I don't go for 20-year gaps like Kristen did, but it's...
I can tell you that there have been attempts to redo this movie. There were rumors of a theatrical animated Mario movie. It's starting in 2014. In 2017, Universal and Illumination announced that they would release a computer animated Mario film. In 2018, Nintendo announced that it was partnering with Illumination, saying that the film would be a co-production. In 2018, Chris Meledandri, who was directing, stated that the film was going to be a priority with a tentative 2022 release date, while saying that Nintendo would be a huge part of the film's creation and that there would be some challenges in making the movie, but that they were going to make something that feels organic to the iconography and can support a three-act structure. Good luck with that. and as late as 2020, the end of January, Nintendo said that the film was moving along for release in 2022. Nintendo would own the rights to the movie, and Nintendo and Universal were funding it. And if you are in Universal Hollywood and I think Universal Japan, they did just recently unveil Super Nintendo World, which they're going to do a mini version here in California. So I'm assuming that this Mario movie would probably have some presence at Universal whenever both of them come out.
Yep, we can't really consider Mario a part of the Disney family anymore, I guess. So just this little thing here. All right, well, let's talk pins. What do you got for pins on Super Mario Brothers?
Can't I just get a blob of fungus?
Want that as your pin, sure, I guess.
Yeah, so a blob of that, calling it fungus. Like, you could say trust the fungus on it.
There you go.
I mean, I was going to be lascivious and say Dennis Hopper with that weird lizard tongue that he's got going on in that one scene.
I thought you were just going to say Dennis Hopper's hair, because, you know, that's...
Yes. And Fiona Shaw in the blue dress, because that was a boss lady move and I loved it so much.
We didn't really mention the Bob-omb, which shows up. That's one of the few things out of the game that shows up, and I'm glad it's there.
I couldn't have told you anything about that because I didn't even hear it.
Well, I wish it had been more like a little guy that's actually a bomb and he blows himself up instead of being like a little wind-up toy. So, but you know, you could do that on a pin. And there's that Vote Koopa sign, which, I don't know, sure, Vote Koopa, what the heck. All right, so what are you going to rate this movie on our scale of 5 Mickey heads?
Okay, so I've infamously given 1 Mickey head. Have I gone half?
I don't. We might have on Super Dad.
I mean, yeah, Super Dad is usually the gold standard of like the worst thing that I've seen for this podcast, and this is up there. I can't say that it's terrible. Like, it's filmed competently. You know, there's that. It's gonna get a 1. It's a 1.
I'm gonna go 1.5, just because
you're kind
of like a few things about it. Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that are kind of fun, but yeah, it's one of those movies that I just kind of shake my head and go, what were they thinking? This is ridiculous. So, all right, well, that's going to do it for our discussion of Super Mario Brothers. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this film or any of the other films that we've talked about. So please feel free to email us at waltsentmepodcast@gmail.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter at waltsentmepod or on Facebook, which is where?
Facebook.com/waltsentmepod.
And Kristen, tell everybody where they can find you.
In my free time, I do a classic film podcast called Ticklish Business, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. And we also do a bunch of bonus shows over at our Patreon, which is patreon.com/ticklishbiz, which Todd and I just did a new episode of my bonus show called Double Features, talking about Little Shop of Horrors. So if you like what I'm doing on our main show, you should check that out.
Absolutely. You can find me at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. That's my main blog. You'll also find links to my other podcast, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast, over there. And you can follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. All right. So what is the next movie that we're going to be talking about?
Todd's really testing me lately. We had to talk about Super Mario Brothers, and now we're going to talk about another infamous bomb that got people in trouble. We're going all the way back to 2012, talking about John Carter. Yay!
AKA when Disney tried to do their own Star Wars before they actually owned Star Wars.
Like if Star Wars and Tarzan had a baby, but it was like all bad.
All right. Well, until next time, we'll see you later.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.